When we come to this book of Exodus, we have one major question I want to tackle before we get to anywhere else. And this is the question. This is what's going to set apart our paradigm for how we're approaching the Word of God from others. Oftentimes when you follow a church or follow a sermon series, we may jump from one book to the next book, or we might have a 60-week sermon series in the book of Romans, and we'll go verse by verse through that particular book, and by the end of the series, you're saying, well, what is the message of this book as a whole, and how does this book relate to the other books of the Bible, or does it relate? Well, the question that I want to ask today is, can this book of Exodus stand on its own? Can we interpret the book of Exodus with just the book of Exodus? Let's go ahead and settle that before we move anywhere else into God's Word. The account that's inside this book is very well known among you as well as among the secular world. The story of the deliverance of the Israelites from the Egyptian people and God's triumph over Pharaoh through various plagues and ultimately killing Pharaoh using the Red Sea. We all know this story. In fact, we even see it popping up from time to time in Hollywood. Recently, there's Exodus, Gods and Kings, the Christian Bale adaptation of the Exodus narrative. Or you'll have before that, Prince of Egypt. It was the DreamWorks animated version. And maybe if you want to go farther into the past, you'll have Charlton Heston's The Ten Commandments, all different adaptations around this one story. It's a story about deliverance. It's a story about a mighty nation oppressing a people and that people being saved by an act of God. It's an underdog kind of story. It's a story that pulls at the heartstrings of believers and unbelievers alike. So we like to tell this story, but whenever we watch these movies, take the Gods and Kings, my wife went and watched it with me, and there's some semblance when you're going through this narrative of an unfolding plot. You have the main character, Moses, and it's following Moses through the story, but by the time you get to the end of the movie, ultimately the why is lacking. Why? What's going on here? What was the point of all this? Why should I care? The story is left unresolved. It starts midstream, and then by the end, they tell all those exciting plagues that happen. You have Pharaoh destroyed, and then you're just left with a people that have suddenly made it out of Egypt, and you're saying, why? What's going on? Now, there are many things we could say and criticize about these Hollywood adaptations, but I don't want to criticize them for something that I think also many of us in Christendom are guilty of, and that is we are missing the point of the story. We're not starting with the beginning of the story. We're jumping in midstream. You see, the book of Exodus, when we come to it, it does not supply the reader with the information necessary for the reader to understand it. It simply doesn't supply it. We come to the first five verses that we just read. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob. And then it names these 12 guys. All the persons who came from the loins of Jacob were 70 in number. But Joseph was already in Egypt. And it leaves us asking, well, who is Jacob? And did Jacob have 70 sons? Why are these sons, these 12 named? What's the point? What's the big deal about that? Why are they called the sons of Israel? And why did they come to Egypt? Or where did they come from in the first place? Why do we even care? It just starts midstream. It is not supplying us on its own with the information we need to interpret the story correctly. So the question is, where can we go? Where can the reader go to find the information necessary to interpret Exodus? Where do we go to find the context? Well, sadly, and interestingly enough, often people will turn to things like archaeological digs. Let's look at this pottery or this settlement that we found. And based on our dating of this settlement, we will add this extra information to help us understand the Exodus account. Or other extra-biblical historical accounts or other frameworks like a suzerain treaty is going to help us to understand why Deuteronomy is framed in a particular way. We're going to turn to extra-biblical accounts so that we can understand the story. No, those aren't going to help you understand the story at all. In fact, we're going to find that mostly searching for extra-biblical data to try to help you understand the narrative that's going on in the Bible is really a waste of your time. It is a waste of your time. It's not going to add anything to your understanding of what the author is trying to tell you. Why? Well, the author is going to tell you everything you need in this story in order for you to understand his story. If it's not included, it's because it is not necessary for you to understand his story. That outside information, you don't need it. There is an individual, the 19th century Russian playwright by the name of Anton Chekhov. He says this, "Remove everything that has no relevance to the story. If you say in the first chapter that there is a rifle hanging on the wall, in the second or third chapter, it absolutely must go off. If it's not going to be fired, it shouldn't be hanging there." So we have this principle. It's in play, in dramatic plays, the principle is known as Chekhov's gun. It's just the principle requires that every element of the story be necessary and irreplaceable to the story, or else it be removed. This is just good storytelling, and that's what the Bible is. We have a real historical account, but it is a true narrative. It is a story, and the author is telling you something. So as we've said in the past, everything that is in the story is only in the story because it relates to the story. Okay? If something is not included in the story, it's because you don't really need it to understand the story. So we stick to the text. Where are we going to go to find the context for Exodus? Well, the context for Exodus, as well as any other book in the Bible, every single book you will find in Genesis. Genesis is where we start. It is the first, is the equivalent, is the only book in the Bible that can really stand on its own in any semblance, in the way that the first chapter in a novel stands on its own. It gives you the trajectory, it gives you the beginning, but it has no resolution. So it doesn't ultimately stand on its own. You recognize it's going somewhere. But without Genesis, we can't make heads or tails of the rest of this story. We have to go back to find our context. Now, as this story starts rolling, we're going to find more information that's relevant. So as I get to Joshua, yes, things that took place in Exodus do matter for us to understand what's happening in Joshua. But ultimately, the only thing that's driving the story is Genesis. Particularly, Genesis chapter 1, verse 26 and 28, God created man in his image to be his representative ruler. They're to rule, bless the creatures. We're going to fast forward this individual rule. We're going to see there's a problem. Genesis 3:15, God's going to send another ruler to fix man's corrupt rebellion against him. But by the time we get to chapter 12 in Genesis, we have a national rule paradigm given. God is going to create a nation to be his representative ruler. So ultimately, this 3:15 one, this promised Messiah, is going to be the king, the leader over this nation, which we know of as Israel. That's why we care about the sons of Israel when we get to Exodus. And they are going to be ruling over the Gentile nations. That's where this story is going. So every book only relates to that. It goes right back to Genesis. You say, okay, I get that for the Old Testament books, but what about the New Testament, right? Like, okay, so the Messiah comes. Do we really care about all this Old Testament stuff and Israel? Does that really matter? Look at Matthew 1:1, or I'll just read it for you. First gospel, right, when we get to the New Testament. The record of the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah. What is that? The son of David. Who is that? The son of Abraham. Why does that matter? We're starting with not enough information. Or maybe if we're going to turn to a book of doctrine, let's look at an epistle. Romans. Romans chapter 1, first couple verses. How's Paul going to start out? Paul, a bondservant of Messiah Jesus, called as an apostle, set apart for the good news of God. What is the good news? Which he promised beforehand through his holy prophets and the holy scriptures. We have to turn left. We got to start at the beginning if you're going to make sense of this story as we move forward. So, Genesis sets the course, and the author is telling us a narrative. Now, last week when we got to the end of the book of Genesis, where did Jacob assign the coming Messiah? Where was this promise? Who are we watching with the camera? Jacob lines up his sons and starts laying out blessings. And when he comes to Judah, listen to what he says. Genesis chapter 49, verse 8. Judah, your brother shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He couches, he lies down as a lion who dares rouse him up. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes, that is, he whose right it is to rule. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. When we get to chapter 49, through Jacob's blessing, the author is assigning Judah. Watch him, the Messiah is coming through Judah. Now, look at the language, very interesting. Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hands shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. Does that sound familiar to us in the story after last week? Remember Joseph's dream? Joseph's dreams? My father and his sons will bow down to me. And that happens in the story. We watch, yes, indeed, his 11 brothers bow down to him. Jacob bows down to him. But when it comes time for the blessing, Jacob assigns that ultimate one to come through Judah. So Joseph serves as a copy, as a foreshadowing, as a type. We see him as the first one sitting in the 315 spot, ruling over his 12 brothers, which are Israel, the sons of Israel. So by the time we finish Genesis, we finish with the book, we have the 12 sons of Israel who are going to form the nation that is going to rule over the Gentile nations. And we know that the promised one is going to come through Judah. So we come to the beginning of Exodus, and the first seven verses pretty much wipes out this generation. We say, okay, we're in Egypt now. Jacob's 12 sons, they've all died by the time we get to verse 6. Joseph dies, all his brothers die, that entire generation dies. And they're in Egypt, and we recognize, okay, because we read Genesis, there's a problem. What's the problem? They are not in their land. In Genesis chapter 12, that promise made to Abraham of this nation who will come from him, who will rule from a very particular plot of land. And this promise has gone from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob and now to Jacob's 12 sons. They're not in the land. None of them have experienced the fullness of this land promise. They're in Egypt. So we say, okay, there's one problem. We follow them. Verse 7, the sons of Israel were fruitful. They multiplied and they filled the land. Once again, the author is pinging us back with familiar information, right? That Genesis 1:26 mandate. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and subdue it. Now we see that God is applying this mandate through the nation of Israel. They are fruitful. They do multiply. They're filling out the land of Egypt. And God is forming what was just 70 people, his 12 sons and their families, into a nation. Okay? In order for Abraham's promise of a nation that will rule and one coming through him who all the people will bow, he has to have a people. He has to have a nation. Remember, from Sarah's dead womb, and Abraham was 100 years old, comes Isaac, this miracle child. We started with one. Now we have a great people. We have a great nation. So I have a nation. Check. We're moving in the direction. But when we come to verse 8 of chapter 1, the conflict arises again. It's just like back in the garden. Suddenly we have this antagonist pop up into the story. Right? The one who directly opposes the character of the protagonist. And the protagonist in the story is God. Not Moses, not Joseph, not Jacob, not Isaac, not Abraham. It's always God. These others are minor characters stepping in, but we're watching God because he's the one with the problem. And he's going to solve that problem. He's going to reclaim a usurped creation. He's going to restore rule. He's going to set his order back in motion. So Pharaoh arises. Verse 8 says, a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. Joseph was at one time the prime minister over Egypt. The king recognized him as being a man of God, that God was with him. And we recognize that God's word, his revelation, is coming through this nation. There is a hierarchy we're about to look at on the back of your sheet. God is disseminating his word through this nation to the Gentile nation. So if the Pharaoh, the king, If he does not know Joseph, then he does not know Yahweh. He does not know God. And if he's not on God's team, he's on the serpent's team. There are only two sides in this story. The line was drawn in the sand in Genesis chapter 3. You're either God's team, seed of the woman, Satan's team, seed of the serpent. And these two are going to be antagonistic towards one another throughout the whole story. So that's what we see. The Pharaoh doesn't know Joseph. He doesn't know Joseph's God. And when we come to the next two verses, he's not concerned with Joseph's God. What he is concerned with is the increasing population of the people of Israel. He's worried that they're going to side with his enemies. There's other Semitic people in the land that are in opposition to Egypt. So he's worried these people who are under his charge, Israel, will side with his enemies and ultimately overthrow him. Basically, Pharaoh is saying, we do not want them to rule over us. We are ruling over them. This is how we like things. So Pharaoh is recalling this enmity. We have the seed of the woman. We have God's son, as he will refer to Israel. And then we have the Gentile nations who are wanting to dominate. They're wanting to reverse the structure that God has set up in order. And so Israel's not in their land. Two, they are being dominated by a Gentile nation. So we say, this is not good. Now look at the back of your sheet. Look at your charts briefly. I want you to see this is where the story is tracking. This is where the story is going. And anytime you get to any part of the Bible, any part, any book, you just need to ask yourself, okay, where are my three circles? God is always on the top. Okay, check. Don't ever have to worry about that. But you see that second paradigm? That's the Genesis chapter 12 paradigm. That's the trajectory that's set for the story. The story is going in that direction. The resolution is going to end there. God, with his nation, his 315 ruler, Jesus the Messiah, ruling over them, and they're going to be ruling, blessing all the Gentile nations. That's the end of the story. So anytime we come anywhere in the story and we say, where is Israel in relation to the Gentile nations? Is Israel in their land? Are they ruling over the Gentile nations? If the answer is no, all you have to do is watch, and that story is going to start correcting itself. It's like a ball. If you were holding a ball in a pool underwater and you let go, that ball is immediately going to want to start going back to the top. It's immediately going to start correcting itself. And this is the track that we have in the story. Now you'll notice on your sheet what we have by the end of Genesis. You have Israel, that little bitty circle just represents there's only 70 people and they've been entrusted into Egypt. They are under Egypt's charge. But by the time we come to Exodus, you'll see that second circle. Suddenly it's large. They've become a nation and we recognize, okay, they're not supposed to be being ruled by a Gentile nation. They're supposed to rule. So you're expecting them to be delivered from under this Gentile oppression. Okay? That's what we're looking for in the story. And it's going to be this same pattern as you go through the story. The problem with Israel is, although God's spot for them is ruling over the Gentile nations, they don't want to be in that spot. They love the Gentile nations. They love their stuff. They love their women. They love their gods. They just want to hang out with the Gentile nations. They want to be like the Gentile nations. So when they do that and they go to hang out with the Gentile nations, God gives them over. They start becoming oppressed by the Gentile nations because guess what? The Gentile nations don't love Israel because the Gentile nations don't love Israel's God. They hate him. They're on Team Serpent. So they want to destroy Israel. So inevitably what you're going to see happen is Israel go over to the Gentile nations into idolatry. God's going to give them over. They're going to be oppressed. They're going to repent, cry out, and God is going to send a deliverer. And we're going to see this go through, this mechanism happen the first time in the book of Exodus. God's going to send his deliverer. It's going to be Moses in Exodus. He is going to judge the Gentile nations. And then he's going to deliver Israel back into her spot. Now, when we get to Judges, this is going to hit rinse and repeat so many times, you're going to be sick of it. You're going to be like, oh my gosh, when are you guys going to get it? And each time they're going to get worse and worse in these little cycles. By the time we get to the New Testament, Matthew, where are the circles at? If I'm thinking, Matthew, what's going on? Where are the Gentile nations and where is Israel? Israel is being dominated by a Gentile nation. Rome is ruling over Israel, right? What happens in the Gospels. The Deliverer comes. The Messiah comes. He's going to call His Son out of Egypt again. He's the greater Moses. This whole thing is going to rinse and repeat. Only problem is they reject their Messiah. So they've remained under these Gentile nations. But He's going to come again. They're going to get delivered. So that's where the story is going. Think three circles. Anytime we're anywhere in the story, say, where are my circles at? And remember that Genesis chapter 12 or 15 or 17 or 22, that Abrahamic promise, which is the merging of the individual rule, 126, and the 315 promise to His national promise. All those are together in that one. That's where this story is going. That's what this life is about. That's your future. We're going in that direction. So, back to our story. Pharaoh has an issue, right? He hates God. He hates God's people. They're multiplying. He doesn't want them to rule over him. He's a Gentile. He's the king of a Gentile nation. He needs to stop them from multiplying. So he institutes plan A. We see it start in verse 11. He appoints taskmasters. He's going to give Israel to harsh labor. He's going to work them to death. But there's a problem. He's using his satanic wisdom to try to solve this, but it seems that the more that he afflicts them, the more they multiply, according to verse 12. He says, I can't seem to stomp this people out. They seem to, the harsher I press them, the more they multiply, so he institutes plan B. This plan is, get the midwives that are delivering these babies, and we will kill off all the boys. Now, if you can convince them, the midwives, to kill the sons in Israel, he's going to accomplish three things. First and foremost, Israel's not going to be able to make war against Egypt. They're not going to have any males to make an army with, so problem solved, right? We don't have to worry about getting overthrown by this people. They don't have anybody to build an army. Secondly, though, this nation eventually is going to be eliminated from existence. They're not going to have any males to perpetuate a nation. They're going to be breeded out, right? But thirdly, and most devastating, is it would ultimately keep any deliverer from coming. Why? The 315 one has to come from the nation of Israel. God has been very specific as we've been tracking the line that the Messiah is coming, right? Right from the beginning, Adam to Seth, we followed all through Seth's lineage. Eventually we get to Noah, follow through Noah's lineage. Eventually we get to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, and we know ultimately Perez after that. So it has to come because God has promised it's coming through this line. Okay? If He wipes them out, no Messiah. And why does that matter? Well, Pharaoh's on team serpent. Seed of the serpent. He's on Satan's team. And Satan is very aware of God's plan, right? Because God told him to his face. In Genesis chapter 3, He says, this one's coming, seed of the woman. You're going to bruise his heel. He's going to crush your head. And he's going to rule. He told him. He knows the plan. So Satan's job, stop the plan. That's what he's going to attempt through Pharaoh. But interestingly enough, these midwives, these Gentile midwives, rebel against Pharaoh. Look in verses 15 and 16. The king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiprah, the other was named Puah. Interesting. Why are their names recorded? Why does the Lord record these two women's names? And He says, when you are helping the Hebrew women to give birth and see them upon His footstool, if it's a son, put him to death. If it's a daughter, let him live. The midwives feared God. Okay, they had regard for Yahweh. And they didn't do as the king of Egypt commanded them. Ultimately, because of that, verse 20, God was good to these midwives. He was, the word is tov, it's a verb form of tov. God toved the midwives. He was good to the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very mighty. And God established household for these midwives. They are named because they are honored women in the biblical text. Think later on, if you think about the book of Ruth, there's an individual who is a dishonored individual. The kinsman redeemer who ought to have redeemed Ruth, but didn't do that, the one who was in line above Boaz. And that's why in the law it says if you don't do that, then you're going to be called, oh, so-and-so. You're not going to be, your name's going to be stricken from the record. So in the story of Ruth, he's just so-and-so. You don't even get his name. He's not honored. He's dishonored. But here, These two Gentile women, they're honored. God gives their name. They rebel against Pharaoh. They see they have a desire for a child to be born. They see little baby boys, remember? In sorrow you will conceive, and you are going to conceive sons. We're not saying sons and daughters. When we look at Genesis chapter 5, the word for sons and daughters is given. But you're going to have sons because we're looking for the Messiah. It's the seed of the woman. That's who we're tracking. So sons are important. So if he's wiping out sons and they have regard for sons, they have regard for Yahweh, following God's desires. So they rebel. So Pharaoh institutes plan C. I can't work them to death. I can't get my midwives to wipe out these sons. I'll just get the Israelites to wipe out their sons. And if they don't, well, then I'll have a cause to wipe them out myself. Verse 20, he commands all the people, saying, every son who is born, you're to cast into the Nile, but every daughter, you're to keep alive. And it's at this point that the author introduces the new main or minor character, the next minor character we're going to follow. The camera is going to zoom in to a particular family, a family of Levites. Chapter 2, verse 1. A man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi. Now, if a Levite and a Levite have a child, then that child is also a Levite. So Moses came from the tribe of Levi. Hint, hint, we already know, wait a minute, he's not the promised Messiah, is he? Because he's coming from Judah. But nonetheless, he's going to play his part. So they have this child, and his mother sees, chapter 2, verse 2, she bore a son, and when she saw that he was, it's not beautiful, it could be interpreted that way, it's Tov. When she saw that he was Tov, again, looking through God's eyes regarding this son and the way that God regards him, good as opposed to evil, beautiful as opposed to ugly, she saw he was Tov, so she hid him. She hid him for 3 months, and then after which she could no longer hide him. So she takes him, places him in a wicker. The word is ark, not basket. Once again, we're looking at a deliverer, Moses, who was spared in an ark as that judgment came down upon the wicked world. In the same way, Moses is placed in a wicker ark. It's covered with tar and pitch, just like Noah's boat. And it's set among the reeds. Now, you know how this story goes. You know where it's going. God's about to make a mockery of Pharaoh. He's going to use irony to make his enemy look ridiculous in the story. Because he's going to have his deliverer, the one who's ultimately going to judge Pharaoh, God's going to judge him through Moses. He's going to have Pharaoh take him in. He approaches Pharaoh through who? His daughter. Do we remember a man, a leader being approached from a woman somewhere in the story? Right back at the beginning, the serpent approaches the woman about the tree of knowledge of good and evil, gets her to eat, and the man with her, he completely reverses that order. God is mocking Satan. He is mocking Pharaoh. He is approaching Pharaoh through his daughter. And then he's going to have Pharaoh raise up the deliverer who's going to overthrow him. He's going to have Pharaoh pay his own mother to raise him. He's going to give him the best education of Egypt. Everything Egypt has to offer. Moses is actually in the lineage, or in the line, to be the next Pharaoh. Won't get into all that extra biblical nonsense because it doesn't really add anything to the story. But the fact of the matter is, the daughter here, the daughter in the story, she doesn't have a son to take Pharaoh's throne. So Moses is in the line to be the next Pharaoh at this point. So as we enter Exodus, the camera starts, we have this body of people. We got the 70 people who's going to be the nation. Our camera's on them, we're watching them. They grow into a large nation. Then the camera watches them start to get persecuted and it zooms in. Our story zooms in and we look at two little midwives. Two little midwives who are supposed to go and kill some babies, but they don't. And then it zooms in even farther into one particular family of Israelites who are supposed to kill their babies and don't. And then it zooms in even farther and our focus is now on Moses, the deliverer. And we're watching him as he's raised. He's raised and the story just skips. It skips straight ahead right to when Moses is 40 years of age. 40 years of age and he's about to set forth in chapter 2, verses 11, he's about to begin judging for Israel. That's his job. That's his position. That's what the Lord is raising him up to do. It came about in those days when Moses had grown up that he went out to his brethren, looked on their hard labors, and saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and he looked that. But when he saw that no one was around, he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. So Moses goes out. He immediately starts delivering. He sees that Israel is being harshly abused. He has zeal for his people. So he judges this Egyptian. But, as we find in the story, he is rejected as the deliverer. His own people reject him. Follow on. Verse 13, he went out the next day. Behold, two Hebrews were fighting each other. And he says to the offender, why are you striking your companion? But he said, who made you a prince or a judge over us? Are you intending to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? Then Moses was afraid and said, surely the matter has become known. And Pharaoh, which I believe is ultimately his uncle at this point, it passes through several hands of Pharaoh's, but his rival to be the king uses this opportunity to try and kill Moses. So Moses leaves Egypt. Now, the author of Hebrews is going to tell us a little bit about this account. In Hebrews chapter 11, that great faith chapter. Interestingly enough, you know who else makes the great faith chapter? Moses' parents. God takes account of Moses' parents and their faith in seeing through God's eyes that the son was good. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 23, by faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw that he was a beautiful, or the word is proper, it's the same word in Acts chapter 7. And they saw that he was a good child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith Moses, when he had grown up, he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than in to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, considering, notice this, the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. By faith he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is unseen. The author of Hebrews, our inspired commentator on Exodus, seems to think that Moses' faith was in the same position that every other person's faith was. That's on Messiah. He is very aware of the 3:15 promise. He is very aware of the one who is coming, just like his parents were aware of the one who is coming. And the Hebrew author just says it. He's looking to Messiah. So, although he could be the Pharaoh in Egypt, although he could have this passing pleasure, he chooses the riches of Christ instead. He leaves Egypt, and we find him by the end of chapter 2, he's out in the wilderness. He's been taken off, and he ends up marrying the daughter of a Midianite priest. In fact, whenever he is rejected as the deliverer of the Israelites, the first thing he does is goes and starts delivering some Gentiles. Notice it in verse, we'll go ahead and start in 16. A priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. Then the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. When they came to Reuel, that's Jethro as well, same guy, their father, he said, why have you come back so soon today? So they said, an Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds. And what is more, he even drew water for us and watered our flock. Moses goes out and starts delivering the Gentiles. And ultimately he stays with them for 40 years. He marries a daughter of the Midianite priest, Zipporah. He has a son with her. The Lord is forging him out in the wilderness. J. Vernon McGee says God gave Moses a BD degree, a backside of the desert degree. Sent him out, said you need to learn something. Or D.L. Moody, he says Moses spent 40 years thinking he was somebody, 40 years learning he was nobody, and then 40 years discovering what God can do with nobody. He's preparing Moses for the position he will ultimately take as God's spokesperson as he overthrows Pharaoh and overthrows Egypt and makes a mockery of their gods. God is setting up the stage. Now, when we fast forward to the New Testament, we're going to see this whole thing play out again. In Deuteronomy, Moses is going to give a promise. Remember, Moses is a very special individual because he spoke to God like a friend, face to face, mouth to mouth. He didn't speak to him in crazy visions that were difficult to understand. No, God spoke to Moses directly. He spoke straight to him. And not another prophet arose like Moses until the Messiah, Jesus. So when Jesus comes on the scene, they are going to be looking for this greater Moses, the one who's going to be a deliverer like Moses. He's going to perform all kinds of signs, right? Moses turned water to blood. Jesus turns water to wine. Moses parts the Red Sea so they can walk through it. Jesus just walks on the water. He's doing the greater Moses signs. But notice how Jesus comes. By the end of this, next week when we start, we're going to find Moses and his brother Aaron, the one who speaks more fluently than him, his spokesman. We find them both out in the wilderness, and they're going to go to Israel, who is under Gentile oppression. God's going to tell them, verse 22 of chapter 4, "You shall say to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, Israel is my son, my firstborn." They're going to go to Egypt from the wilderness and call Israel out from under Egypt. When we come to the New Testament, what do you find? You find a voice of one crying out in the wilderness, John the Baptist. You find Jesus going out to meet him. He is baptized. And he is calling his son, Israel, out from Egypt. It's Hosea's reference. Hosea is going to say Israel's back, going to go back under Egypt. And then he's going to say, but really it's Assyria. And Assyria becomes Babylon. Babylon, Medo-Persia. Medo-Persia becomes Greece. Greece becomes Rome. Out of Egypt, Jesus from the wilderness is calling my son. This whole thing is playing out again. It's a divine book. You can't make this stuff up. You can't piece this together. You're going to have 1,600 years, 40 different human authors piecing a story together with foreshadow after foreshadow after foreshadow of piece after piece after piece representing this one individual who's going to show up on the scene, embody the whole thing, and then do it even greater than the first time you saw it around? That's a story. That's the real story, his story, our history, the story we're living in. So where we live today, we know the deliverer has come. He came, was rejected by Israel, but you know what? God's word has to come to us, the Gentiles, through Israel. So you know what he did? He took 12 apostles and he sent those apostles, those Israelite apostles, out to the Gentiles. See, when Matthew chapter 10, the first time he sends them out, he says, only go to the perishing sheep of Israel. Don't you go to the Gentiles. But then they reject him. So by the time we come to Matthew chapter 28, he sends them out to us. Because Israel was supposed to take the message to us and they didn't. So now as apostles take the message out to us, we have the message. The message is the good news. It's the good news of the Messiah who did come, Jesus the Christ, who came, was crucified, was buried, rose again as proof of our justification, as proof that we will be resurrected because he already has been. They've taken the message to us. We're to take the message out in this particular period of time, even to Israel, because they don't know. They still reject him. But ultimately, he's coming back. He's going to come back for us. Then a period of time is going to ensue. Israel is going to repent, accept Jesus as their Messiah. And then that little sheet on the back, that little Genesis chapter 12 paradigm, that's where the story's going. It's all going right back to there. Okay? That's where this story is headed. So do you know him? That's the question. Do you know the deliverer? Do you know that he is the one who has come? There is no deliverance apart from him. That's why it's such an obscene thing. In fact, God actually gets upset. We'll see it in the story with the children of Israel because they keep, in the book of Judges, they keep going off to idols and to worship other gods. Gods in whom there is no deliverance. After a while, he says, why don't you let those gods deliver you then? See, there's no deliverance from anyone apart from Yahweh and his Messiah, Jesus the Christ. God's the judge. We've offended him. There's one way out, and I hope you know that way. is by placing simple faith and trust in Jesus as your Messiah, as the Son of God. That's it. You got nothing. You got no work. You got no merit. You come to this place condemned. So if you don't know Him, place your faith and trust in Him today. I implore you, be justified before the Lord on His righteousness.